Good afternoon, everyone. Good to see everyone who's here, and hello to everyone who's on Zoom. Nice to be here with you. Chose a better time of year to visit this time. The last time I was out here was in January, and it seems like I have a knack for hitting ice storms. So good to be able to be here with you this time. Hopefully everyone had an enjoyable feast and is getting settled back in after that as well. I always get an interest in looking at things that are consistent themes that repeat over the course of time. And there are certain struggles that mankind has that just keep going on and on and on, very much common denominators in the history of mankind. And one of those that maybe we don't think about very often is energy. You know, when you look back at the history of mankind, one of the key things that we've always had to do is search for sources of energy. You know, you go back and you see the early depictions of life and what it used to be like, and something as simple as fire. Starting a fire, keeping a fire going. If any of you have visited old homes and things, you'll sometimes see how blackened the insides of old homes are from the soot as they would have to burn things inside to try to stay warm and to cook food. From there, things moved on. The burning of oil became a thing. I remember reading a study about lighthouses in the United States, and there was actually a thing for a while where lighthouse keepers would be eating the fuel because there was a choice. You'd have fuel that was actually consumable as well. You think of olive oil that was burned for a time, where people would actually have a choice between were they going to eat it or were they going to burn it for fuel. Whales were eventually discovered to be just large floating blobs of fuel when you think about blubber and the whole whaling industry that took off for quite a bit of time until finally coal was discovered. Coal was distilled down into kerosene, which burned a lot cleaner than that, and eventually we got to oil, nuclear power, solar power, wind power, and even those have their challenges because even though the wind blows, it doesn't blow reliably. If you live in places like this and like Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from, you can't count on the sun shining all the time and it's hard to store energy. So there's been this constant search for energy and a store of energy because the one thing that we know is there's no inexhaustible supply of energy that we can tap into. And it's not just energy in terms of fuel. Physical and emotional human energy is an issue as well. And it's something we all struggle with no matter what age we are. If it's not getting tired from doing something, it can be just feeling worn out and sapped from different things. If any of you are familiar with Asian medicine or you've ever been in Asia and walked through a store, you'll see all the concoctions that are there, bird's nests, strange extracts from glands of animals you've probably never heard of. All of these things, teas, things that are made up to try to bring energy to people and to help them. In the West here, we're used to caffeine. Nowadays, energy drinks, you see Red Bull on people's shelves and all the other things they take for energy. And we accept the fact that in our human lives as well, our human energy is limited. So I'd like to talk today a little bit about weariness. Weariness is a real thing and it has an impact on our lives. I'd like to read an article from April of 2011 that talks about one way that this takes place. This was a study that came out at that point in time. In the interest of full disclosure, there have been other studies that contradict parts of this that have came out since. But reading from a UK publication, The Guardian, in April of 2011, the adage that justice depends on what the judge ate for breakfast may not be far from the truth, according to a study of more than 1,000 court decisions. The research, which examined judicial rulings by Israeli judges who presided over parole hearings in criminal cases, found that judges gave more lenient decisions at the start of the day and immediately after a scheduled break in court proceedings, such as lunch. Jonathan Lavav, associate professor of business at Columbia University, who co-authored the paper, said, "You're anywhere between 2 and 6 times more likely to be released if you're one of the first 3 prisoners considered versus the last 3 prisoners considered." The authors of the peer-reviewed paper looked at more than 1,000 rulings made in 2009 by 8 judges. They found that the likelihood of a favorable ruling peaked at the beginning of the day, steadily declining over time from a probability of about 65% to nearly 0, before spiking back to about 65% after a break for a meal or a snack. The exact reason for the shift from parole approval to a default outcome of denial is not clear, but the paper speculates that breaks may replenish mental resources by providing rest, improving mood, or by increasing glucose levels in the body. Lavav said, "I don't measure the judge's mood. I don't measure the judge's glucose level. It's just a very consistent empirical regularity." And if you read, it's not hard to find all kinds of other articles that are out there. People who run businesses, CEOs who are responsible for managing a large portfolio at business will often say, some of them will say they will not make an important decision after 10 in the morning. Others very carefully calibrate when they set meetings, especially in the afternoon when they know they're drowsy or short-tempered. And probably if we think about it, especially if we've ever had a toddler as a child or a grandchild, we know how much we depend and consider energy levels, crankiness levels that go around with low energy and tiredness, and how it impacts people. You know, at this time of year, we can often struggle with emotional weariness. We've all come back from the feast. It was just a couple of weeks ago. We're going into the winter, and in climates like this, places where I live, the grayness and the wetness and the coldness kind of descends, and it can be a time of year that just saps us emotionally as well as physically. And it impacts other things. It impacts how we treat our loved ones. It can impact how we perform at work. It can impact how we care for ourselves and our surroundings. And of course, it can impact how we tend to our spiritual lives. So let's spend a little bit of time today talking about the topic of weariness and hopefully looking at a few things that we can take away that will be useful as we go through this upcoming season. As a first thing, let's look in the Bible and talk about a few of the things that are laid out in the Bible that can cause weariness. And it's actually a pretty diverse set of different circumstances when we look at it. Let's look at one in Psalm 69, pointing out the fact that we can get weary with waiting, just waiting for something to take place. In this case, the psalmist writes about waiting for an answer from God. Psalm 69, verses 1 through 3. Here we read, "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in deep mire where there's no standing. I've come into deep waters where the floods overflow me. I'm weary with my crying. My throat is dry and my eyes fail while I wait for my God." Probably any of us can think of times that we've gone through as we've waited for an answer from God. We've been in situations that are difficult for us, cause pain of whatever sort. And we can become weary just waiting for that answer to come, can't we? We can also become weary of studying. Any of us who are in school right now, especially coming back from the feast and trying to catch up on schoolwork, probably get a little bit weary from studying as well. If we read in Ecclesiastes 12, we don't have to feel bad about that. Even the Bible talks about this, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 12. Here written, "Further, my son, be admonished by these. Of the making of books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." I think any of us who've spent any amount of time in school can know what that's like. You've got to spend endless hours studying the books, and unless you find ways to take breaks, you can become very weary. We can become physically weary also. Let's turn to 2 Samuel 23. We'll read one example of this. In verse 10, this is not directly talking about something we do. This is David and his mighty men fighting the Philistines, and we don't really get into physical battles, slaying people physically these days, but certainly we put our hands to a lot of physical efforts that can tire us out. Here in 2 Samuel 23, verse 10, describing David and his mighty men, "He arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. And the Lord God brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder." Now, if you've ever gone out, you've done work in your yard, you've had a saw in your hand all day or an axe, you know what that feels like at the end of the day. It's almost like you have to struggle to open your hand back up. It's so tired from gripping whatever you're gripping to work with it, and that weariness can strike us. One last passage we'll read as we think about the different ways we can be weary. We can actually be weary from doing good. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 13. Here Paul, writing to the Thessalonians, says very simply in this verse, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. So all kinds of circumstances can come along in our lives, all kinds of activities, things that are good, like doing good for others, things that are bad and difficult. All kinds of different things can cause weariness. And the examples abound even beyond that in the Bible. We won't turn there, but if you want to look at some point in time, you probably remember Elijah when he fought against Jezebel and the prophets of Baal. And 1 Kings 19 talks about the weariness that came over him as that battle didn't end exactly the way that he thought it was going to, and he became despondent. Moses would be another example in Numbers 11, as the children of Israel just came piling all their complaints and problems on him before his father-in-law suggested that he delegate some of that authority, and it made him weary and tired. So, very basically speaking, weariness is part of the human condition. It's something that can come on us physically, it can come on us emotionally, from all kinds of different sources, some of them positive events that happen that can nevertheless sap us emotionally when they're finished, and others from negative or difficult things. So that leads us really to the next thing I'd like to consider for a few minutes, and that is that while weariness is a normal physical and emotional response, it's also something we have to manage. And the Bible gives us plenty of examples of actively managing weariness so we don't simply give into it or become overcome by it. You know, Jesus Christ himself is a fantastic example of that. You know, he was God in the flesh, but let's turn to Luke 5. We'll see something that he did on a very consistent basis as we read in the scriptures, verses 15 and 16 of Luke 5. This was as he was going about preaching, and he was doing a number of miracles. And we read in Luke's account, in chapter 5, verse 15, that the report went about concerning him all the more. So people were hearing more and more about what it was that Jesus was doing, and great multitudes came together to hear and to be healed by him. And what is it that he did? He himself often withdrew into the wilderness, and he prayed. So being both fully human and fully divine, Jesus was very much conscious of himself and what he needed to sustain himself from a physical and spiritual perspective as well. And he did two things. He physically withdrew himself. He went away from the crowds. He went away from that constant press that was coming on him so that he could physically rest. And he also prayed. So he both turned to God, but also, importantly, got physical rest and physical separation from the situation that was causing fatigue or weariness for him. And that's something we should consider as we think about ways that we manage our own selves and we deal with the potential for us to become weary. You know, I mentioned a moment ago the examples of Elijah and of Moses. Elijah certainly got into a situation where he was so overcome with everything that he basically couldn't function. If you remember, he went off into the wilderness and he was basically telling God, I'm worthless, I'm done with this, I don't want to do this anymore. And God dealt with him in a great amount of mercy, as he does with us. But if we look at the example of Jesus Christ, compared to how it happened with Elijah, Jesus Christ never allowed himself to get to that point. He made that habit of dealing with his own weariness proactively by knowing when he had to withdraw and when he had to turn to God in order to cope with that. Let's turn to a couple scriptures. I'd like to look at an analogy that's used relative to weariness and managing it. First, we'll turn to Paul's writings in Galatians. And let's look in Galatians 6, verse 9, and just read this one verse and what it lays out for us. It's Paul's writing to the Galatians, Galatians 6, verse 9. Here he says to them, "Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart." So not only telling us not to grow weary, but lays out an analogy here of due season and reaping crops. James carries that on in James 5, verses 7 and 8, as he uses the same type of agricultural farming analogy as he's talking and writing to the brethren. James 5, verse 7, he says, "Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." And we might not always connect these two verses firsthand, but you can see that they're doing two things that are congruent with each other. One of it is talking about your heart, Right? Paul talks about the fact that we should not grow weary in doing good because we'll reap if we do not lose heart. And likewise, James is talking about establishing the heart. And again, using that same agricultural analogy. And what is it that's in common here? It's the idea that things that feed our heart take time. And we have to tend to that. We have to realize that using the analogy of farming, the time from planting to harvest is a long period of time. It's a number of months. During that time, good things happen, bad things happen. Rain falls, storm comes through, maybe drought comes, maybe insects come. And things have to be tended, crops have to be tended all the way through, and that patience has to be part of it in order to establish our heart, in order to ground our heart, and that's going to be the determining factor if that patience and that grounding and establishment of our heart is there. And so that leads us then to the inescapable question of how. We know we're supposed to establish our heart, we know we shouldn't grow weary, and we won't if we do that, but how is it that we go about doing that? Fighting weariness in all of the different forms that it comes into our lives. I think this is where we have to remind ourselves of something that we probably, again, don't even think about so much because it's just part of our physical world. But the idea is something called entropy. Now, I think there's some engineers out there who could probably put us to sleep talking about all of the things that entropy are and what it means. But in general terms, entropy is the idea that anything physical is moving towards decay. Now, most of us, all we have to do is look at the mirror in the morning, and we'll prove that out, won't we? But think about it. Anything that we deal with physically, we take our car to the car wash and we wash it. What's the one thing that we know? A week later, it will have rained, we'll have driven through a cloud of dust. Somehow, magically, overnight, dirt just comes down out of the air and lands on our car. And it moves from this order of a nice, shiny car to being dirty. Probably one of the biggest proofs of entropy would be in a teenager's room. You clean your room on whatever, let's say it's Friday afternoon before the Sabbath, you get your room nice and clean. What is it that we can guarantee that room is going to look like by Sunday or Monday? Right? Life goes on, things get thrown in different places, something falls off a shelf, things move from this order into chaos. And we see this in all of the different things that are going on in the world. Well, we often look at society, and what's the first thing that people with graying hair like me often say? Man, it's not the way it used to be, right? When I was young, people didn't do X, Y, and Z, right? And we all think of the ways that we look at the way that we think society has degraded or changed or moved to the worse from the time when we were younger. And it's probably the thing that every generation has in common is that every generation thinks that things have gotten worse over the course of their lifetime, perhaps with a lot of truth to it. But at the heart of the matter is this. Everything physical moves from this order to decay. It just, we can't escape it. There is no inexhaustible form of energy. You know, like I talked about before, human beings have searched for energy sources. We've even found things that are relatively sustainable, like, for example, water energy. But all of these things can end, and we've never been able to find something that's truly unlimited. You know, this has gone on as well as people have looked at their own lives. How many have heard of the Fountain of Youth? Right? We remember the explorer Ponce de Leon came from Spain and was looking for the Fountain of Youth all over the Caribbean. You know, the story of the Fountain of Youth actually dates back to the 5th century BC. There's a historian named Herodotus in the time of the Greeks who was searching for the Fountain of Youth. So people for literally millennia have been trying to figure out some way that they can escape the inescapable, the decay of the human body, recapture youth, turn back the clock. And all of the ways that we try to do things, the way that we generate power, the way that we do work, are all somewhat exhaustible. You know, at one point in time, we used mules and horses to do a lot of work, didn't we? Remember when I was a little kid, I'd read stories about the Pony Express, and they would talk about the need to, after they were galloping across the West a certain distance, to rest their horses. And I remember as reading about that as a 10-year-old, and I'd think, you know, the horses are this, they're these massive beasts, and I couldn't imagine why a horse would need rest. it was just such a large animal, right? And it seemed, from the point of view of a kid, to have this limitless power in it. But even huge animals, even an elephant, can't work without end. It needs rest. It gets weary. And so this goal has gone on and on and on over the course of time. Let me read a short snippet to you from Britannica, Encyclopedia Britannica, about this. This is about perpetual motion. So one of the things that people have thought over the course of time has been, maybe we can create a machine that will stay perpetually in motion and so can generate limitless amounts of energy because it'll just keep moving on its own accord. Britannica writes, "Perpetual motion, the action of a device that once set in motion would continue to motion forever with no additional energy required to maintain it. Such devices are impossible on grounds stated by the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Perpetual motion, although impossible to produce, has fascinated both inventors and the general public for hundreds of years. The enormous appeal of perpetual motion resides in the promise of a virtually free and limitless source of power. The fact that perpetual motion machines cannot work because they violate the laws of thermodynamics has not discouraged inventors and hucksters from attempting to break, circumvent, or ignore those laws." And of course, that's also the story of humanity, isn't it? We never like to believe that something's going to be impossible. I guess that's part of the greatness of humanity as well, because we continue to try things, we stretch our boundaries, because sometimes we just don't listen to people who say things are impossible. So where does all this take us? Let's focus now on the end of where inexhaustible energy comes from. You know, when we think about God, it's probably not the first thing we think of, but what's amazing to me when you think about the greatness of God is something that is completely beyond the physical realm and something we just cannot do, and that is to generate our own energy. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, we can't. But God can. God is himself a source of limitless energy, and it's one of the things that makes him supreme, different, and beyond anything that we can even imagine. Turn with me, if you will, to Isaiah 40, verse 28. Isaiah 40, 28. Probably this isn't the first attribute of God that we would come up with if someone asked us what the attributes are of God, but the more I've thought about it, the more that I think it's actually one of the greatest attributes that God has, because so far beyond anything we can even comprehend physically. Isaiah 40, 28. "Have you not known? Haven't you heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, he neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They'll mount up with wings like eagles. They'll run and not be weary. They'll walk and will not faint." How incredible is that? You know, we all go through those seasons in our life, whether it's as we get older and our physical strength starts to ebb, whether it's just the cycles and things that happen in life that sap us emotionally and make us wonder if we can go on. These scriptures, this passage in Isaiah, is just incredibly powerful in terms of what God can do. And we have the ability to move to this source of energy, of power, that can renew us in every single conceivable way. Have we ever thought about God in that way? An endless source of power. In Matthew 11, Jesus Christ talks further about this in a slightly different way, talking here more about emotional and spiritual needs. And it's one of the few scriptures where Jesus Christ really describes himself. Matthew 11, verse 28. Here Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavily laden, and I will give you rest." So he's saying, are you weary? Come to me. "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." This reference to the yoke, right, talking about animals out in the field where they have the wooden yoke around their necks and how hard they would work their animals in order to plow fields during that time. And Jesus is saying, I'm different. Whatever it is that you need rest from, When you take my yoke on you, it's easy, and the burden is light. I can sustain you, and I can give you the power and the energy that you need. So God is the unending and the inexhaustible source of strength, and in him is the only solution to weariness. I find that topic or that term, exhaustive, interesting too. What do we talk about when we think about natural resources? Sometimes we'll hear about the fact that sources of oil or coal are about to be exhausted, right? They'll be completely gone. We talk about our own selves physically, sometimes mentally or emotionally. We talk about being exhausted. One of those core elements of God is he is completely inexhaustible. There's no end to his energy, to his power, to his life, to his being. Something so completely and incredibly beyond what we can be physically. So as we tie all of this together, moving towards the end of this message, we've looked at the fact that weariness is a natural human condition. That can result from all kinds of different factors, some of them positive, some of them negative. It's just part of what we're like as humans and as any physical creation. And in a spiritual sense, going back to the analogies that we see written in the Bible, if we want to reap the harvest, we have to be careful. We have to tend to our hearts in order not to become weary. And this takes energy, and thankfully God is a God of inexhaustible energy. So as we close, let's go back for a moment to the analogy that both Paul and James used about establishing our hearts. And let's tie their admonition back to the reaping of a harvest, which really takes us back to the feast. I think this, to me, is an interesting point of view that we see about why we keep the feast, what it should do for us, and the cycle that we're going into now as we move away from that time of the feast. Turn with me, if you will, to Deuteronomy 14. We'll read verses 22 and 23. Many of us were probably reading Deuteronomy in the period of time before the feast, which was very instructive and useful. And this is a passage that talks about the feast and actually talks about the topic we were discussing today in a way that we might not always think about. Verse 22, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year, and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain, the new wine, your oil, the firstborn of your herds and flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." So if you're familiar, we see this around us here in the fall when we see county fairs pop up. Some of you might have relatives or people you know in other countries, and you see in all kinds of countries around the world and cultures all over the place, one of the common things that people do is have a harvest festival. Right? The harvest comes in at the end of the year. There's lots of food. Everybody celebrates. They've filled up their storehouses. They're getting ready for the winter. How's the feast different than that? It's in this last line here that we may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And there's something embedded in here that I think we have to think about, because it's about this cycle of life that just keeps going on. And if we're not careful, we're just on this treadmill and getting worn out with it. And if it's not for this last element of why we keep the feast, it's basically, well, we've gone through another cycle. We're not as tied to the land as the people of Israel were at that time. But if you put yourself for a minute in their shoes, they'd reap the harvest. They went away from their land, went up for the feast. They celebrated. And what were they going to have to do next? It's that unending cycle of life, right? Because if you don't plant the next crop in the spring, if you don't tend to it over the course of the summer, you're not going to eat, and you're going to have a lot of problems because you might not make it through the next winter. But there's something additional that's hidden in here, I think, in terms of understanding the fear of the Lord at the same time as keeping this festival and celebrating all the plenty that's there. And that's realizing that there is this power, this inexhaustible source that's underlying all of this. In the case of the Israelites, in the case of us, having to realize that the blessings that we have, the things that we have, all of it sources from God. We're not stuck in this endless cycle of produce, harvest, store, plant again, produce, harvest. There's something bigger going on because God's called us to that. He's given us his inexhaustible source of energy through his Holy Spirit, and he's called us to something that rises way above this ongoing cycle of life that just sort of devolves and ages and breaks down over the course of time. And he's given us a calling to something that's greater. So one element of God's greatness is that he's not subject to weariness. And even through the feast, even as we go through kind of reestablishing ourselves into the habits of life after the feast, one of the things that we continually can reflect back on is the lessons of the feast, the things that we've learned about God, the things that he's doing in this world, the larger plan that he's building that goes beyond just what's going on in our day-to-day. And that's the concept I'd like to leave everyone with today and encourage everyone to think about this as we go through the upcoming weeks. What's our source of power? What's our source of strength? When is it that we feel weary? What is it that causes weariness? And are we turning back to that inexhaustible supply of power and strength in order to combat that weariness? So as we move forward in life here, coming back from the feast, let's consider the ways we can better establish our hearts in God's endless supply of energy in order to counter our physical weariness.